Welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Here, we speak with extraordinary games industry professionals and listen to their story to learn all about what they've built and who they are. GamesNet Berlin Europe is the international games industry initiative of MediaNet Berlin Brandenburg, the networking association for the media, creative and digital industries in Germany's capital region. My name is Simon Oler, and I will be your host for this program. Today, we are speaking with Stephen Lee. Stephen is the head of business development at Decca Games, a publisher that focuses on old games, actually, that need a little bit of a revival. And Stephen tells us all about Decca Games, their philosophy, what they do, what he does for them, whether Decca Games is a retirement home for games or not. And then we hear about his career. And most importantly, I think Stephen has something to share about publishing in the East versus in the West. Because before Decca Games, Stephen was at Six Waves, and he did make waves in the publishing market in Asia. So that's something special we have for you today with Stephen. Beyond that, we talk about where Stephen comes from, why community is so important to him, what practice for a balanced life Stephen can recommend and actually does share with people in the games industry and beyond, and how Stephen engages himself in sustainability projects. Stephen is humble, cool, and smooth, and we have a lot to talk about, and it was very good to catch up with this old friend of ours. So we hope you enjoy it too, and we hope you sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Stephen Lee.
Hello and welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. I am Florian, my co-host Simon is on board, as always, and our guest today is Stephen Lee. Stephen is the head of business development at Decca Games, living in Berlin. Before that, he was longtime head of publishing at Six Waves out of Hong Kong and brings over 12 years experience in generating bridges for games and businesses between East and West and the mobile publishing world. Before sending it over to Stephen, a quick heads up. This podcast now has additional two co-hosts. My new cats, Bimo and Mochi, are here now. So they are 4 months old kittens. So please excuse any unforeseen podcast interventions. They are only junior co-hosts. And now that that's out of the way, welcome, Stephen. Tell us what's important to you at the moment.
Yeah. Hi, guys. It's a pleasure to be here. What's important to me right now is living my best life, trying to balance business and personal life. I'm trying to stay happy, healthy, fulfilled in everything I do. Excited to be here and happy to dive in with you guys today.
Happy to hear that there are finally kittens in the building, and happy to hear that Stephen is living his best life.
Podcast gets better and better with each episode.
Kittens, fulfilled lifestyles. I mean, what else could we ask for?
Exactly. Stephen, let's dive into your career, I think, a little bit. So you mentioned that, or I mentioned in the intro, that you are at Decca Games. Can you tell us a little bit about Decca Games, what they do and what you do there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, happy to. Decca is quite a unique publisher, I would say. So most publishers are companies that developers go to when they're looking to launch a new game and really scale it and get in front of a large audience of players. That's actually not something that we do at Decca. And I know that sounds super weird, guys, but we're known more for our expertise in live ops. So what we do is basically help studios to take care of their existing live games. And the main idea is that over time, games performance will decline. And, you know, a lot of times it's has nothing to do with the quality of the product or the team. It's usually teams lose focus over time. And it's usually because They're focused on a new launch. So they've got an exciting new game that they're getting ready to work on, or they're getting ready to launch. Or maybe the studio is pivoting and the old game is no longer strategic. Or you know, studios get bored over time and they're just, they're turn their attention to other things, right? And so, because of that, we see a ton of games out there that, you know, still have players that are loyal and they love the game and they come back every day, every month, every year. But you know, the experience and obviously the performance of the game starts to decline over time. So, it's just not possible for studios to fully support, multiple games in their portfolio. They have to really choose where they want to focus. So, usually that's the biggest game, you know, doubling down on their biggest game in the catalog, because that makes the most business sense and the most commercial sense, right? So, you know, because of that, we see, a ton of games that are really, you know, could be doing a lot better. And so that's the challenge that we're trying to help solve for the games industry at DECA. So, we basically take over, existing live games, usually the older games and the neglected games. We help them, to perform better, and we help provide the best, experience for the players, that we can. So it's kind of like resurrecting or reviving, reinvigorating older titles, of which there are tons of. So that's our business model in a nutshell.
That's a really cool idea, first of all. And then I assume also a cool business model, or I assume it works that way because you're at it for quite some time. Do you think, like, why do people keep playing old games? What's the motivation behind that?
Yeah. And if I may just add something, because this is the question that is on my mind right now as well. Also, like old mobile games specifically, right? Like the games that you are doing, I'm not a customer for that. I don't really play games on my phone. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious, in addition to Florian's question, what you can tell us about the customers, the players here.
Yeah. Great question. I think there's a couple of different factors. Mobile games specifically are designed, you know, in such a way, like free-to-play games, as we know, you know, in theory, you can keep playing them forever, right? And what we've seen is that, especially for players that are spenders or highly engaged in the game, there's something about the game that they just love. And in a lot of our games, I think the common thread is often the community, you know, game players love playing with their friends or other players and engaging in the community within the game. And that helps keep them coming back. And I think over time, if they're invested a lot of time and money, hopefully, you know, and there's sort of this sunk cost and they're like, well, I'm already invested in this game. I want to keep playing it and I want to keep enjoying it. So, you know, our role as operators of these games is to make sure that they're, you know, continue to enjoy this experience so that they come back, because there's so much more competition out there. There's new games launching all the time. Lots of different ways that the world is trying to steal their attention. So we hope that they can continue to enjoy the games that they love.
Yeah, and I guess if you have some money spent and, you know, you're invested, like you said, then it is a really good feeling to have like this counterweight, right? This counterbalance, this knowledge of, okay, here's a developer who actually is still there. You know, a player can feel the presence of a developer, you know, or of an operator of a game, that there's news, new things come out, the game is somehow moving and stays fresh.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one thing that you brought up earlier, Simon, is that yes, we are mobile focused, but actually, our first game, the game that the company was founded on, was actually a Steam game. It was originally built in Flash, and that game was acquired by Kabam back in the day. It's called Realm of the Mad God. You can find it on Steam. And that game is still going strong. I think it's in its 11th or 12th year right now. And we recently rebuilt it completely, because obviously Flash is no longer with us. But we completely rebuilt it and launched it in Unity so that the players can continue to enjoy it and, you know, the experience.
Okay. So that's a bit more than just quote, a mobile game that's actually quite a classic as far as I can see, right? It's like a bullet hell MMO or something.
Exactly right. Yeah. So, yeah, that one's exactly how you described it. I couldn't have done, described it better. It's on Steam. It's not mobile, but it is free to play. So we kind of think of ourselves as sort of free to play experts, and that's sort of where we try to remain.
I like that you said Flash is no longer with us. Like Flash was an old friend that we all miss, but I think we are all quite happy about that.
Absolutely.
I mean, I had some good times in Flash, you know. Sure. I don't know if that I played some miniclip.com and like, you know, in school and Newgrounds, isn't that all Flash? Like, yeah, yes, I mean, I'm pretty sad that Flash is no longer with us, or at least I have some fond memories of this old friend.
No doubt about it. Me too. Me too, Simon.
Good all old, right. Good old alien hominid or whatever, little, you know.
Nice.
So do you think, or is there something that is there a point at where developers usually figure out, hey, this game I would like to keep it alive, but I no longer have time for it? Or so do the people find you in a way, or is it more like you go out and say, hey, have you ever thought about reviving your old games, or are you still providing service? Wouldn't it be easier to hand it over to somebody? How does the process usually work?
Yeah, great question, Florian. It's normally, I would say when I joined the company about 5 years ago, it was more the we would approach other people because to be as open as possible, a lot of developers didn't really know that this was an option. Mm-hmm. So in the past, they would just sort of slowly move people off of the game and onto the newer or more important project, or they would maybe leave a skeleton team behind the game, or even worse, just let it sit there and slowly die and decay over time, or you know, collect revenues as for as long as they can before they decide that it's no longer profitable, for example. So yeah, I think over the last you know, almost 5 years, we've been really great about letting people know that, hey, rather than those things I just described, you can actually think about letting someone else take over the game on your behalf and make sure that it's in good shape for as long as possible. So yeah, that perception is, I like to think, has slowly changed over the last going on 5 years. And so now we're getting a lot more inbound stuff, a lot of referrals from industry friends and connections where people are like, oh, you know, you should probably talk to Deka. They're really good at it. And we also see some competitors popping up, in the space as well. People trying to replicate our model, which is, you know, in a way a validation because, I think, you know, we wish we could help with more games in fact. And there's a lot of great games out there that, you know, could be doing better. So, you know, the more people doing this, I suppose the better news that is for players and developers.
Are you, a retirement home for games?
No, I wouldn't. I guess you could say that, but I mean, that's one way to look at it. I think, of course, there's, when games are older, a little bit further along in the life cycle, that's what we're really good at, taking care of them. But in a lot of cases, it's not really this, like, you know, extending the life. In some cases, it's even improving the performance of games. So reversing the trend of the game and helping it to, you know, maybe all-time highs in some cases, which we've done in for a few of the titles that we've acquired.
Nice. So you're a revivement home, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we give the games a shot in the arm. yeah, something like
bat
that.
Pat on the back. Yeah, here you go, yeah, buddy.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is also a support structure, right? And how do you choose these games?
Yeah, really, really great question. It's really not an exact science. You know, there's a whole combination of factors that we look at. Obviously, you know, the P&L, the game, it needs to make commercial sense. It needs to be of a certain size and scale for us to consider it. And that bar is going up over time. But I think it, you know, there's a lot of other considerations. So, you know, technical considerations. So what kind of code is it? you know, is it a standard engine like Unity, which is becoming more and more common? But, you know, a lot of our games in the past were, you know, proprietary engines, really old tech, spaghetti code. And you know, we have to look at the code and understand, okay, how difficult is it to, would it be to maintain and make updates? All of those things factor into the evaluation. A lot of other things, you know, like, how dependent is the game on marketing, right? You know, these days, publishing is not what it used to be. Marketing is way more expensive. Targeting is less precise. So if there's a game that's super heavy, reliant on marketing, that's makes it a lot less attractive for us, right? Because our business model is relatively low risk, where we're usually operating on and working on stable products that have really relatively stable KPIs. Is there a community somewhere? You know, I mentioned community before. That for us is usually a really, really good, healthy sign for us and gives us more confidence in taking over a game, because if there's that strong community, then we've been able to engage with them and, you know, basically work really closely with them to provide the best experience. And you know, it's kind of like a healthy thing that we look for as well.
Quick cut in there, or quick question about community. How do you measure community? Do you just look at player base? Do you look at like Discords? Do you look at Reddits? Do you find the community?
It's a little bit of everything, but usually we actually just ask the developers, like, hey, where are your players? Where are your whales? Where are your most important players that are vocal or spending or really helping to keep a game alive in terms of activity and engagement? And it could be on any of those platforms that you mentioned. It could be Reddit, could be Discord, forums even. So that's been one of the most important drivers to our successful track record is kind of earning the trust of the community and, you know, making sure that they're on board with what we're doing. And in fact, that has served us really well, because even though we're not spending a lot on marketing games, we're actually able to grow games in terms of audience and improve the performance because of the community. Because a lot of times these players are just, you know, clamoring for someone to come in and help them and, you know, pay attention to them, give them more stuff to do in the game, more ways to enjoy the game. And then when we finally take over, they're usually so excited and grateful that they help us to re-engage other players, you know, people that from their guilds or people that they used to play with, their friends, you know, they spread the buzz and the word of mouth. So that's absolutely vital for us. And if we see a strong community, that's, as I said, that's like a great sign for us that the game is an attractive deal for us.
Nice. As Deka Games, at some point, I think it was a year ago or so, maybe correct me if that's wrong, were acquired by Embracer Group.
Think... Yeah, that was just over 2 years ago. So, over two years. August 2020.
All right. I guess Embracer Group, for those who don't know, is a pretty large group that owns many studios and different IPs. And so... for their strategy, I think it made a lot of sense to have Deka Games in the portfolio, thinking of how many IPs there are that you could work with. And correct me if I'm wrong, but was that sort of like the first idea of why they chose to cooperate with you or to acquire you?
I think it's definitely one of the main reasons. For as long as I've been with the company, before we got acquired by Embracer, we've been talking to, you know, basically everyone in the M&A space, because as you correctly pointed out, Florian, what we do is quite complementary to any games business, right? So I think it was a good fit. And one of the reasons why we decided to go with Embracer, is basically their model is also quite, different and interesting, right? Because I think a lot of times, when you are acquired, usually in the games industry, you're joining a much larger entity and you have to fit into that organization in a very specific way, right? And there's a lot of mandates and directives and they tell you what to do and they pull the plug on projects and that kind of thing. And the Embracer model is, you know, quote unquote decentralized, right? Where, mm-hmm. they're, for the most part, hands off. And so it's more like, hey, you guys are doing great work. Keep doing what you're doing. And you know, hopefully we can grow together. So that was really attractive, I know, for Ken, the founder of DECA. And it's been really great for us so far.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. We spoke before that we in the recent episodes or in the last few episodes, there were some talks about this whole M&A. So we don't want to go super deep into that topic, but just from your perspective in general, how do you, if you can make a prediction, how do you think the space will evolve over the next 3 years? What do you think is happening? Because it's pretty crazy still at the moment.
It's pretty crazy. I think people are definitely a little bit more careful. People have pumped the brakes on M&A a little bit. The valuations are coming down. But I think the whole industry as a whole, I kind of like to think of it as like an IO game, you know, like people are just swallowing other entities and getting bigger and bigger. So, I don't see that changing anytime soon. I think the industry will continue to consolidate and, you know, the big players will look not only for other studios, but anything, you know, that is valuable, right? Like for acquiring studios for capacity. You know, the Embracer strategy is definitely really interesting, right? So not only acquiring studios, but IPs and, you know, physical board games and, you know, most recently Lord of the Rings, which is super exciting. So, yeah, I think people are just trying to, secure whatever might be interesting and have synergies, within the whole gaming ecosystem, right? So bringing, digital games to physical media or to movies or TV shows, for example. I can see all of that kind of happening in the future as well as people kind of continue to, sort of grow and acquire assets, let's say.
And I have to say one thing here. I'm kind of like clicking through the Embracer website on the side. And two things I'm noticing. One is that the company, the Embracer Group, is actually cultivating a games archive, if I see this correctly.
It's yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, Lars, the CEO of Embracer, he's like a huge retro games guy. And yeah, that's one of the things that's on my list is to fly to HQ and visit that archive. Seems like it would be a really fun walk through memory lane.
Yeah. And then the other thing is that it's very funny, like, because the website is like a group website, you know, kind of official and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Then you kind of click through it and there are all these great companies who have great games. And so I'm getting like this funny mix of great playfulness and big business. And I don't know, I kind of like it, I have to say.
Thanks. Yeah, we're also pretty happy. Like people always ask, like, you know, how's it been for you guys? And
yeah,
it's been great. I mean, we in the past when we would acquire a game and do a deal as DECA, we would have to kind of, you know, just use our own cash. And so if we acquired a game, we'd have to wait a while for, you know, the games to generate more revenue before we could do another deal, right? And so it was kind of slow but steady growth. And you know, since we got acquired, that constraint is now gone, so we've been able to grow much more quickly at post acquisition. So it's been very good for us.
Yeah, feel that.
Do you let's switch a little bit to another topic, which is that before living in Berlin and before DECA Games, I said you were working for a company in Hong Kong, Six Waves.
Yeah.
Were you also living there?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. So I actually moved to Hong Kong all the way back in 2000 during the original .com days and kind of bounced around a little bit, but eventually ended up at Six Waves. They gave me my start in the games industry. So I'm eternally grateful because, you know, a lot of times, I don't know if you guys have ever been through this situation, but you know, sometimes when people are trying to find work and, you know, they see a job opening or a position, a company that seems really interesting, you know, and if you apply and you don't have the relevant, you know, years of experience, you know, you're not really considered, right? And but how do you get the years of experience unless someone actually gives you a chance? And so I'm very grateful that the CEO of Sixwave, Arthur Chow, he actually kind of saw my CV and was like, hey, this guy's got pretty good, you know, background. Let's call him in. You know, and we hit it off immediately, and the rest is history, as they say. So yeah, eternally grateful and still really close to the team at Sixwave. It really feels like a family. We, you know, we had a nice catch up last month in Helsinki. So yeah, those guys are doing super well. And they exited recently as well. So really happy for the whole Sixwave team.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit, because I was kind of missing that now from the Deka conversation. I know you're a business developer, so maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you're doing at Deka and then also what you did at Sixwaves. Mm-hmm. And maybe from that we can kind of get into the whole publishing in East and West. I think that sure. might be a good line.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, so my official title, I mean, we don't really go like care about titles at Deka, but I'm officially head of business development. What that means basically is I'm the business facing person for the company. So I'm talking externally to the industry, to any potential partners. It could be platforms, it could be developers, publishers, any types of partnerships. I'm kind of the top of the funnel. Most of the time looking for games to acquire or studios that we can potentially acquire or partner with. Yeah, my role at Sixwaves was also similar, mostly meeting developers, trying to find games for us to publish. And that role, which initially started as biz dev, kind of grew over time to encompass the whole publishing operation. So yeah, also trying to figure out how we can find cool and interesting games and make them more successful.
Right. So if anybody has a cool and interesting game,
Exactly. Yeah, so publishing has been sort of the main thing I've been focused on in all my years in the industry. And I have to say, I feel like I love my job because I love talking to developers, and it's really wonderful to see the enthusiasm that developers have. And when they're showing you the game and they're super excited about it and you can see it and feel it and I love that part of the job so much, and it's I'm very grateful that, you know, not everyone gets to do what they love and make money from it, you know, as a profession. And I think the three of us are pretty lucky to be working in such an awesome industry. So yeah, it's really, really an awesome job, and I really love it.
And what have we found out? What have you found out? You know, working in the West and working in the East, because you're our first guest, I think, who has that kind of experience. And I think you have a story to tell, especially about publishing.
Yeah.
It might be interesting to our listeners.
Sure.
Who are from the industry themselves. What do we need to know about publishing in the East versus the West?
Yeah, it's good. Good question. You guys are full of good questions today. As I don't know if you guys can tell by how I'm my accent, but I'm originally from the US. I'm from upstate New York, as they would say. So, you know, when I actually moved to Hong Kong in 2000, it was definitely a huge culture shock for me. And it took a long time to quite some time to understand how people live their lives and their habits. And, you know, as I had a chance to travel around Asia, you know, it was really interesting to not only see the history, but also a lot of the cultural differences between the different countries as well. So I think maybe one of the most relevant examples I could give is that a lot of times people would always ask me, like, hey, Steven, like, I'm thinking about bringing my game to Asia. You know, I've got a Chinese version of the game, and I'm using air quotes right now. You can't see that, but you know, the first thing I'll ask them when they say that is like, okay, so what do you mean by, you know, Chinese version of the game, right? Is the text in simplified Chinese, or is it in traditional Chinese? You know, are they speaking Mandarin or you know, and if they're speaking Mandarin, is it mainland Chinese accent? What, you know, is there kind of provincial accent, or is it, you know, a Taiwanese accent, which is completely different? And a lot of times, Unfortunately, like most of the time, developers have not thought this through because, you know, technically, yes, you can lump us all three of, you know, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and China as quote unquote Chinese people. But across those three territories, which, you know, individually are huge and really substantial gaming markets, there's very different habits, very different behaviors, different way of reading and speaking. And even if you're talking about launching your game, the social graph is different too, right? Like everyone knows that WeChat is ubiquitous in China. They use it for everything. But for messaging in Hong Kong, for example, it's quite similar to the West. So everyone uses WhatsApp or Facebook Connect, right? Facebook Messenger, let's say. But in Taiwan, strangely enough, everyone uses LINE Messenger, which is Japanese kind of mobile network. So, you know, a lot of people don't really understand that. And so when you just kind of do like a lazy localization and you're not really thinking about, okay, where am I going to focus first? Which market do I want to tackle first? You know, I think a lot of people have a lot to learn there. So, and that's just, you know, quote unquote Chinese version of the game. Right. And, you know, we're not even talking about Korea or Japan. So, yeah, it's more about sort of educating people like, hey, don't just think that it's one size fits all. It doesn't work that way. And definitely don't sign your publishing rights to a single publisher for Asia, because there is no publisher in Asia that is number one in all of those markets that I mentioned, right? The top publishers in China struggle in Japan, and the top publishers in Korea struggle outside of Korea. So, yeah, it really is for developers and publishers that want to go to the East, it's a really question of, okay, where do I want to focus first? And do I have the bandwidth to work with multiple partners in multiple markets and maintain multiple SKUs of the same game, right? Or do I want to consider handing that over to a local partner, let's say? So it's a lot of things to think about, but you know, if your game is really big and you put the time into doing that analysis and looking at the different markets and the different opportunities, you know, you can have a lot of success. There are Western companies that have done quite well in Asia because they put in the time and they have boots on the ground, and that helps tremendously.
Do you think that is it feasible for small indie developers in general to think of, and now I say Asia as a whole again, we just said that it's not even Asia as a whole, but in general, comparing a whole continent divided, does it make sense for smaller teams to even try to touch or to touch ground in the Asian market, or start at one, or which ones do you think is the most accessible one?
Yeah, that really depends on the type of game. I would say, you know, if you're developing like a MMO on PC, for example, you know, take a good look at Korea. If you're developing, let's say a hyper casual or super, you know, maybe an ad based mobile game, definitely look at China if you can find the right partners. But I think it's not necessarily like the right prescriptive approach for everyone. So I think it really depends. Everyone's situation is different. So a lot of times, some of the more successful indie developers, they will look very closely at their dashboards and their metrics and figure out, oh, wow, okay, we're getting actually quite a few players in Southeast Asia or in China for some reason, right? And if there is some type of indicator there that, hey, maybe there's something here, then it makes sense. I think that's a good indicator that, okay, wow, we have like a couple thousand players in this market. Let's talk to, you know, potential partners in that market to figure out what we can do to leverage on and build some more momentum and maybe hopefully get that ball really moving. I would say that's probably more, that makes more sense than to just say, okay, China's the biggest, let's go China first. Because every situation is different. Every game is different too. And it's, as much as we like to be able to predict the future, it's not an exact science, right? It's sometimes things just catch on and you can kind of figure out why they happened, but other times there's no logical explanation, right? And
yeah,
something has caught on in a specific market and nobody knows why, but it happens. And you know, for developers, why not, you know, try to build on that and you know, get some more success overseas.
Yeah. My knowledge on this is pretty slim since I also haven't worked on any games projects for quite some time now. But what I would be interested in is, do you see, and then I can maybe also elaborate on why I'm asking this, because I used to work at Black Pants Games and we had some games. It's a small indie studio, still based in Berlin. And we had some games that were Steam games, and some of them also mobile, but a few years ago already, for some reason doing well in China, for example, and we couldn't really figure it out. So for the next upcoming one, we added Chinese localization. Luckily, one of our guys, like wife, is from China, so she could do the translation. But it was for us always, since we didn't work with a publisher, we were self-publishing, we could never really understand, for example, why the Chinese market liked it that much and where sometimes the downloads came from Steam, etc. So that was always like a black box for us. Do you think that, I have to count back, that was maybe 7-8 years ago. So do you think that this black box in terms of being from Europe or from America has somewhat become more see-through? How was the process in the meantime? Were companies like Six Waves able to make it more approachable or more easy? Can you tell a little bit about the timeline?
The timeline. I guess it's getting a little bit more transparent. I think over time I've seen, you know, sort of, if we're just speaking about China, I've seen Chinese publishers and companies really trying to learn and have sort of greater focus towards the West. So, you know, they're, in the past, it was, when I first joined the industry, it was quite challenging to, you know, be able to communicate everything really clearly when you're trying to explore a business opportunity, right? And I think now that's no longer the case. I think the gap and the communication gap is starting to shrink. At least that's been my experience over the years, where you have a lot of younger, well-educated mainland Chinese people that speak pretty fluent English, and they spend a lot of time playing games in the West, and you know, they're hungry and proactively reaching out to local studios. So I think that things have shifted, and I would say in both directions as well, in terms of how games, the appetite of players in the West compared to players in the East. So for example, back in the day, it was really hard to convince people to pay to win, in Western markets, because it's unfair, right? You can't really, it doesn't make sense, and it really kind of, it's not balanced. But for the longest time, that was a completely normal thing in Asia, because it's all about face, and you have people spending ridiculous sums of money because they just want to show how wealthy and how powerful they are. And I think that mentality has also shifted over time, where it is accepted for people to pay to win. You know, a game shouldn't be necessarily designed in that way, but it's more acceptable now than when I first joined the industry. So I don't know if that fully answered your question for it, but I see a lot of, I guess to sum it up, I see a lot of movement from China and other Asian countries towards the West, and then vice versa, right? Like the trends and things and features and things like that from that were really common in Asian games becoming more commonplace for Western games as well.
Mm. Since you brought it up, the pay-to-win mechanic, it's kind of a trope, I guess, at this point to say, well, Asia likes pay-to-win and the West doesn't. But do you also think that when you say it has become more acceptable here now, and I mean, we can definitely see it in many more games. Does it also then work the other way around? How is it with like Western monetization models or Western styled games? I assume that they then also become more accepted in the East.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a pretty astute assumption. And actually, at least for mobile, it's definitely, some of the trends in the West have become very common in the East as well. So, you know, I guess the easiest example would be like, you know, ad monetized games, right? I think that was sort of frowned upon back in the day in Asian markets, and mm-hmm. now it's definitely accepted and commonplace because it's, you know, companies realize that they're leaving money on the table when they're not allowing, you know, people to watch ads. And in fact, in China, I mean, I'm sure you guys have heard, you know, it's really difficult to acquire licenses to launch games in China. So one of the workarounds that Chinese publishers have come up with is just, hey, you know what? Instead of, we're just going to convert your free-to-play game to completely ad-supported, and that allows them to launch a game in China without a license. And some developers and publishers have had success in China because of that.
Mm, that's an interesting tidbit.
Yeah.
Do you actually? Oh, sorry. Do you have something, Flo?
No. All good.
I was wondering if you have like maybe a kind of a success story for us. I don't really know what I'm getting at, but we've talked in quite general terms. And in your time at Six Waves, am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Six Waves, you know, we kind of talked about this. Okay. You have to get this right, right? If we're mostly talking about if you're from the West publishing in the East, right? I'm not sure if we covered the other way around very much.
It's a little bit of that, but it's also, I think at Six Ways, when I first joined the company, we were not even publishing on mobile yet. We were still focused on Facebook games. So we were one of the largest social games publishers on Facebook. If you guys remember, like, you know, the Farmville era, or, you know, like, you can send your friends for sale, you know, when the Facebook timeline was really viral and spammy, right? So at one point we were actually the largest publisher of games on Facebook. I would say we achieved a ton of success because we helped a lot of developers actually get pretty big and successful. So I would say, especially companies in Eastern Europe. So, for example, Playrix, we published Township on Facebook, you know, Game Insight, Pfizer, Naval. These are all huge companies from Russia CIS region. We were their publisher on Facebook initially. And then for a lot of them, we were also their publisher when we shifted to mobile. So launching a lot of their free-to-play social games on mobile in Asia as well. So, yeah, I still have a lot of really close relationships with a lot of those companies because we kind of helped them, you know, basically grow and get their start. So I'm very proud of that, that track record, I would say.
And do you want to tell a little bit of a story on how they did it? Like maybe just one example or something, like the kind of things you got right with somebody. I don't know who that might be, just if a story comes to mind. Somebody who you helped, you know, get it right, and how did that look like? Or
I think
which pitfalls did you avoid? Or
yeah, exactly.
Concrete story from an example, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a lot of times, you know, developers. I'm hugely generalizing, but a lot of times developers really you know, their heads down working on their game, right? And they feel like they know their game the best and better than everyone, and with good reason. But a lot of times, I think the most successful examples of publishing success are ones where developers have developed a really open and harmonious relationship with the publisher, because it's always this push and pull about, okay, like, it would be great if you guys adapted this or changed this or think about modifying things in the game in this way, for example, like changing the look and feel of a product, for example, or pricing, or you know, cadence of when we're doing events, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, sometimes, you know, I would say publisher is not always right, but you know, if you're talking to a publisher with regional expertise, usually they kind of know their market the best, right? And so the most successful collaborations have always been with those developers that are open-minded enough to say, okay, you know what, you know, let's take their advice and we'll invest the time and resources to adapt as you recommended before we launch. Or, I think that's been the common thread, in all the successful games, is that it's not really, we're forcing them to do anything, because ultimately we publishers can't force the developers to do what they don't want to do. So it's more like the developers kind of sees the value of the insight and feedback based on our experience, right? And are willing to take that chance and invest the time to make changes to the game. And then sometimes, you know, the inverse is also true, right? Sometimes you have all the confidence in the world in launching a game, but for whatever reason, you know, it doesn't take off the way that everyone expects and hopes, and that's when the difficult conversations have to happen, where, you know, developers are like, hey, you know, why don't you spend more money behind our game, right? And you know, there's always that push and pull about like, hey, you know, we need to also see good metrics before, you know, we're able to invest more on the marketing side, right? So I guess that was a bit of a long-winded answer, but I think in terms of success story, you know, I think it's all about when you have a super open dialogue and you feel like developers and publishers have ultimate trust in each other, and there's no kind of grumbling like, you know, yeah, we don't really want to do it, but we will. It's more like, oh yeah, like that makes a lot of sense. And what about this? What do you think about this? And then we will also, you know, think about that as well, right? Because it's not like one party telling the other party what to do. It's more collaboration and bouncing ideas off of each other and being open to being wrong and to try new things together. So, yeah, that's
trust. Sort of,
yeah, exactly.
Openness,
trust.
True partnership is what I'm hearing.
Exactly right.
Those are the keys. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you got it.
Cool. What I didn't know, actually, which is interesting when you brought it up, that you were originally from the US. So I always thought that at some point you moved to the US, but you are from there. So what I'm interested in is what made you leave the US in the first place? Then afterwards, I want to go a little bit further into your backstory. So what made you make the jump?
Yeah, this is a really funny question, right? And when you meet someone, the most common question that I'm sure you guys get all the time is where are you from? And I know you guys also have lived in different places and have pretty complex upbringing as well. And I found that people just ask that because they want to, I guess, some way to understand you better, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and maybe that's a desire to connect and relate better, right? They're to figure out, oh, okay, you're from this country, right? They want to be able to put you in a bucket and understand your frame of reference so that they can hopefully build a rapport with you. And it becomes very difficult though, when people ask you, and for example, like, hey, I always say I'm from the US, and when I'm not in the US, people are always puzzled by that, and they You know, they're like, where are you really from, right? And this is something that happens a lot.
You learn to tell your life story real quick in very few sentences as with a confusing past, which I can tell from experience.
Yeah, when I was in Hong Kong, when I was living in Hong Kong, people will go, I would say, oh, I'm from the U.S., but I live in Hong Kong. And they're like, oh, you're from Hong Kong. And I would say, no, I'm not from Hong Kong, but... Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, ultimately, it just depends on how much you want to get into it. But yeah.
And you know, sorry to interrupt again, but in Berlin, it's a bit the other way around. Then you're like, you always have people asking you, are you from Berlin? And you're like, yes, I'm at home here. That's what I usually say. And they're like, but are you from Berlin? And you kind of have to dance this dance around the real Berlin resident card. And then I'm like, yes, well, I am German, but I'm not born here. And they're like, okay, so you're not a Berliner. And I'm like, if that's what you want me not to be, then have it your way.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like, yeah, whatever, man.
Whatever, man. Yeah. Please accept me, but okay, no.
Yeah, exactly. So, to answer your question, Florian, the reason I moved to Hong Kong, long story short, I was living in Manhattan, in the consulting world, and I wasn't really happy with my life there. And it just so happened that one of my really close friends from university was in Hong Kong, and there were three of us that were best friends. And this was, as I mentioned, this was during dot-com days, and we mm-hmm. were talking, and he said, this was before cell phones were really popular, but I remember we had to get a calling card and dial him long distance from New York. But basically, there were two of us in New York. One of the guys is in Hong Kong, and he said, "Hey, look, you know, there's this startup here in Hong Kong, and they're looking for people with tech experience, right?" And this was during the bubble, and so we were like, "Wow, that sounds super interesting." So they flew us out to Hong Kong, and we spent a week in Hong Kong, interviewed, and, you know, a week before that, we weren't really expecting anything like that to happen. If you had asked us about it, you know, if we see ourselves living in Hong Kong, I would have probably laughed at you. But it was an amazing trip, and you know, I think the three of us, you know, when you guys talk to your best friends, I'm sure you're always like, hey, you know what, we should do something together, or wouldn't it be cool if we, so you guys know how it is. So it was kind of like, wow, you know, we always thought it would be cool to do something together. We never really thought it would be so soon after university, but you know what, like, what the hell? If it doesn't work out, we can always come back home. But, you know, for me, it was a great opportunity to see, you know, the other half of the world and spend some time in Asia, get in touch with my roots, I guess, and you know, explore the world and have some fun with my best friends as well. So it was kind of an opportunity that I couldn't really say no to.
Now I really need to ask, because that is a very like funny and intricate constellation of people then moving over to. I mean, usually when I have this discussion with some of my friends, then they are at least somewhere in Germany. So, and maybe I wasn't living in Germany. So at that point, it was more complicated again. But usually, like, for you to move over there, and then obviously now it's quite some time later. So not all of you are working still together in this job or with that opportunity. Mm-hmm. If it's not too blunt, how would you rate the experience of working with your best friends, and why did you move on?
Oh, wow. I love that question a lot. Thank you. I loved working with them. It was really some of the best times of my life were, you know, newcomers to a city. And, you know, I think at the time, the dot-com era was pretty fast and loose, I would say. Mm-hmm. In all aspects. So, you know, we were just super excited to be there. You know, we kind of had our own team within the startup. And so we could work, collaborate with each other and just kind of do our own thing. And, you know, there's the, you know, the cliche of work hard, play hard, but we did everything together. And so, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything in the world. It didn't work out because Obviously, the dot-com era didn't last forever, and we could see that bubble about to burst. So we decided it was better to move on to other things.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So one step, this episode, we are going backwards for some reason. I don't know, but I wanted to ask, I saw what I found a funny little nugget of information that I was digging from your LinkedIn. You were at Cornell University, and at that point, that makes it really clear why in the US people have a lot of these side activities while they're at university, or they are more open in sharing them. So I found out that you were in a Last Call a cappella group.
That's right. Yeah. Wow. You did some real sleuthing there, Florian. Yeah.
I scrolled way to the bottom of the page.
Wow. Yeah. So, I've always been a singer. And so, I got recruited. I tried out, and actually there was a guy living in my dorm, in the suite that I was living in. And he was in this a cappella group that had just started. And so he was like really pushing me to try out. And I think at the time I was really insecure, and you know, I still am to some extent, but I was really shy about it. And he was like, just come. And I'm very grateful that it worked out like that, because being part of a group and performing is something that I really enjoy and still doing to this day, I would say. And some of the group, some of my friends from the group are some of my closest friends in life. So it was really cool to be in on the ground floor of a new group, because I don't know how familiar you guys are with a cappella groups. It's like, what you see in like Pitch Perfect in these kind of movies, right? And at the time at Cornell, there were two really well-established groups, and they were like part of the Glee Club, where, you're wearing like a blazer and singing the old standards, and it's pretty stuffy and limited, I would say. I mean, they're really talented guys. But our group was completely new, and we tried to really shake things up. We did a lot of comedy sketches and had a very different approach. So we tried to be more accessible and very open and inclusive. And so it was really great to be a part of that in the early days. And my friends and I, basically, when we were there, we helped to formalize the group, and we made it an officially recognized group on campus. I remember drafting the constitution of our group in the computer lab, if that dates me a little bit. Mm-hmm. And now seeing the group, being nationally recognized and performing on national TV, and seeing how amazing they sound now, there's no way I would make it into the group today, but it's pretty awesome, and I still enjoy singing. If any of you guys ever overlap with me at a conference, or even in Berlin, we could do a karaoke. Actually, Simon, we've done karaoke before.
We've done karaoke.
So absolutely. I think as I was thinking about today's podcast, I think a common thread of my life has been community and collaborating and working with others. I'm definitely not a loner in that, and that I really enjoy doing things with other people.
Yeah, that I think is a good thing to say, a good way to live, and I think a good transition to bring us into a few more personal topics.
Uh-oh.
And I would love to come back to the community thing. But to make it maybe a bit exciting, if that's something that's a thread, would you like to tell us a bit about how you grew up? Because that's kind of, we're getting into, home base and roots already a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think it's always very interesting to hear what, people like you, the guests on our podcast, people who are entrepreneurial or very productive and, are looking for a bit more from life, where they come from, and how they grew up. So if you'd like to tell your story a little bit, we would love to hear it.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate that. So I actually grew up in New York, and people, when they hear New York, they think of New York City. I grew up just outside of New York City in a county called Westchester County. And if you guys are comic book fans, Westchester County is where the X-Men are based, or where they used to be based. So, and, you know, kind of like suburban life in America. And it's where you live when you don't want to live in New York City or Long Island. It's really, really nice upbringing. I have to say, I'm really, really grateful for my upbringing, because the town that I grew up in was, and the county, Westchester County, is known as a very affluent area. And our family was not well off at all. But I think my parents did a really great job of making some astute choices and being able to find affordable housing in a really good location, a very convenient location with access to great public schools, which, you know, leads to all kinds of other things. So I recognize my privilege of being born an American, and you know, they say that, you know, the biggest predictor of your success is your postal code, right? And I feel very fortunate to have been raised where I was. And you know, I think if one or two decisions had gone differently, there's no way the three of us would be having this conversation today. I mean, my mom grew up in Taiwan. My dad is from mainland China, also grew up in Taiwan. And you know, who knows, right? Maybe I'm a completely different person and not living. Maybe I spend my whole life in China or in Taiwan, and I wouldn't be necessarily working in the games industry. So I'm very grateful for that. The upbringing, I have to say, was pros and cons to everything, right? I have to say, very stereotypical, strict Asian upbringing, right? The focus was on achievement and doing well in school and, you know, getting good grades, right? Because that leads to more opportunities. And so because of that, I have to say, you know, my parents did sacrifice a lot, and I wouldn't change that, but I, you know, there are cons to that as well, right? I think, I don't know how familiar you guys are with Asian households, but it's very, very conservative. Maybe not so comfortable to talk about feelings and express feelings. It's right. More about buckling down and working hard and doing well and being tough and resilient, and maybe wasn't the most safe environment for emotional development and being able to be open and expressive. And that's, you know, something that I'm working on to this day. So
catching up a bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's a good way to put it. And do you, I know that's an Asian thing, like you said, or can be. And I think it's also, for some reason, I talked to a lot of first generation immigrants in my recent months of this year, and I heard many stories. And if I got you right, your parents did emigrate/immigrate, right?
Like that's right.
And then you were the first generation born in the U.S.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So, if you don't mind me asking, what did your parents do? Because that's also always a challenge. What was their occupation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm first generation. We call it ABC, American born Chinese.
Right.
And my mom was a nurse. She's retired now, but she was for many years worked in the labor and delivery department of a hospital, and also teaching Lama's classes on the side. So all about childbirth and babies and making sure that people have healthy babies. So yeah, she worked really, really hard. And for many years of my upbringing, she worked the graveyard shift as well. So, you know, overnight and coming back first thing in the morning and sleeping during the daytime. And
oh, wow.
You know, she made a lot of sacrifices. My dad was in insurance. So he's, I would say, more of an intellectual. And yeah, they're both retired and healthy and happy in New York. But yeah, it was an interesting upbringing to say the least.
Yeah, but so that's always interesting, right? Studying these stories that I've heard. So your parents actually were part of companies, part of the system. I've that's right. And then I've heard many first generation or immigrant stories as well. From Indians in Germany, I've had some contact recently, and other examples where the parents, those who immigrated, so to speak, did not join the system and actually joined the and actually opened their own business, right? Like a bodega or a shop or a restaurant, like the typical ways where you can kind of live in your own culture. So I think that's also interesting to point out, is the joining of society, which not everybody manages to do as an immigrant.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. There's a lot of these Asian stereotypes, right? The Chinese people that have a restaurant, or the Koreans that have a grocery or a shoe repair, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, I think for my mom, she really enjoyed her nursing. And so that was an easy choice for her. And, you know, my dad, I think it was more just trying to do stuff that he enjoy and figure out a way to support the family as well. So I don't think they didn't do the entrepreneurial thing. But I think, I think they're open-minded to it, but I would say they're one of these parents that, I don't think they fully understand what I do.
So Steven, they just know what you do one more time.
Yeah. So they're just sort of like, they know that I'm in IT, you know, and it's been like that for years. So anything IT tech related, they're forwarding to me. And I think more recently they understand that I'm in the games industry, but, it's a difficult bridge to gap.
Yeah. Bad. So, okay. So you have you're in a great neighborhood, even though you have this culture around you that if I hear your story right, it does has a bit of a constraint to it, maybe also for you as a person, but well, you're living. So what do you do? How do you go about your day as a kid? What do you like? Also maybe bringing in a bit of the, you know, just the a cappella story, you know, you obviously have something in you. Can you express yourself? You know, how do you live as a kid, as a youngster?
There's a lot to unpack there, Simon. The a cappella part, I guess
I'll do what first. You like. Don't have to do everything, right? Whatever you feel is fun to tell.
I think it was, I ended up at the a cappella part because, you know, when you're in school, we had to do as many activities as we could take on, because that's the best chance of getting into a good university, right? So musically it was orchestra, band, or choir. And for me, I just settled on choir because I played violin as well, but I wasn't enjoying it. Singing seemed like an easier route, and it worked out well for me. In terms of other things that I enjoyed doing, I was always really active, so I was in this interesting middle ground where I was one of the, you know, sort of nerds in school, but I was also really athletic, you know, playing soccer, captaining the soccer team and that kind of thing. So I kind of like was floating in between the different stereotypical high school crowds, and, you know, was able to kind of be friendly with people across those different crowds as well. So it was always about being active, being on teams, doing student activities. I was thinking about this earlier. Actually, because we weren't really very well off, we never really had gaming consoles growing up. So gaming was always kind of like a special treat, like when you go to your friend's place to play, right? Or when you go to, you know, your parents want to go to one of their friends' places, and then the kids have to play together. And if the kids have a console, then it's like one of the few times a year we get to play console games, right? So
yeah, jackpot there.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it was, I always loved games, but I never got to play them as much. And I guess I'm making up for lost time now as well. I think the first console I ever owned, if you can call it that, was the original Game Boy. And that was only because when we went to Taiwan as kids, my uncle bought us Game Boys, and it had the little cable that would link them so you could play Tetris against each other. And it was like my parents were like dead set against us having it, but he was super nice and insisted. So that was sort of the first console I ever owned would be like one of those, you know, monochromatic original Game Boys with the adapter.
Same here. And what year was that for you? And how old were you then?
I don't remember exactly. It had to have been late 80s, early 90s. When we have to Google 93? When the first Game Boy launched. But but it was
Game Boy Classic.
Yeah, yeah. Had to have been like 89 or 90, something like that.
Yeah, you're right. Really nice. First time sold 21st of April, 89 in Japan.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Good old days.
You were then, may I ask your age or your birth?
In 89, I was, 13 years old.
Yeah, 13. Yeah.
I found it funny. Like my mind was wandering off into constellations where I like that you got your first Game Boy from your uncle, because I always, and then the interaction with your parents, because I assume, and that might like be very stereotypical to say, but I assume it's kind of a politeness thing to then accept it still, although parents were against it.
That's right.
I'm now thinking of, because I always try, I have nephews and I always try to make gifts or give gifts that I think are cool, but I also want them to be like in any way educational or like not by any bullshit. Sorry to say like this, but, it's really funny to then think, obviously I would be, sometimes more inclined to buy maybe a Game Boy or an equivalent today, like a Switch or something. The discussion with the parents about that, I haven't yet breached that. But I feel like that now it's very like common to ask the parents like, oh, would it be cool to gift this or something? But I always have this little voice in my head that says, just buy something really, really cool. They have to accept it anyway. The kids will be very angry if they don't. So I'm always a little bit on the edge of like, maybe I should start influencing a little bit.
Absolutely. I think it depends on what kind of relationship you want to have with the parents.
Hey, here's a little culture change to your household. Take that. Yeah. See what you would make of it.
I think it's great, like, you know, to be the cool uncle, right? To just show up bearing gifts and then you don't have to worry about the consequences. I've been there as well.
Oh, my. So true. But yeah, I mean, yeah. I really remember this, you know, for me, it was the same Game Boy Classic and my stepdad, basically the boyfriend, later husband of my mom, had it. And until then, I was always playing games at my friends, right? So, I've told this sometime before, but I think I learned how to make friends very well also to like supplement my resources, which at first was like access to video games for sure. So
yes.
I've definitely had some video game friendships. Kind of just kept the rotation going, right? One day here, one day there. And, nice. The Game Boy Classic came to me through my stepdad and, I think it was on a holiday in Denmark. And I was we have a Game Boy? And my mom was kind of like, you know, like shrug and well. And I'm like, well, is this mine now? You know? And just went in. And so, yeah. And I still have it. It's in the room I'm in right now.
Oh,
so
nice.
Is this Game Boy in the room with us? Yes, it is.
Amazing. So,
yeah, I definitely became the owner, the proprietor of this piece of technology with great joy.
So cool.
Took good care. But yeah, it's this, you know, the parents are like, no, this is not the culture we want. And then, you know, it sneaks in anyway. Mm-hmm. Well, bless the uncles, right? The uncles and the stepdads. Yeah.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
And so what were your first... contacts with video games at friends? I mean, you're a bit older than we are, so What are the first, can take us really retro, Stephen.
Yeah, believe it or not, I remember the Atari, the original Atari, very well. And that was, you know, during like, you know, you could play like war, you know, and there's different like modes where you're essentially, you're like a dot or a line, you know, like, and playing Pitfall or, you know, Yara's Revenge and, you know, those kinds of things. But I probably spent a lot of time on the original NES because we had close family friends that had an NES. So, you know, obviously everyone played the Mario games, but my favorite from the original NES era was a game called River City Ransom. I'm not sure if you guys remember that one.
Can you say it one more time?
Yeah, it's called River City Ransom. It was kind of like an old side-scrolling beat-em-up, but then it also incorporated a lot of really fun like co-op and RPG. So you could like go into the shop and read a book and then learn and, you know, gain strength and eat something and gain speed. And it was like really rudimentary, but it was two-player co-op. Kind of like Double Dragon style, but you could like, you know, do a lot of things with other players. And yeah, that game was amazing. That was probably my favorite from the original NES.
Just looking at it, looks great. Fast fists and trash cans. That's great.
Yeah, you could even pick up the other player and use the player as a weapon and hit enemies with the other player, which is awesome. Okay. Yeah.
Against their will, I assume.
Yeah, usually.
Perfect. But those are the best games. Co-op games where you can use your other players without them agreeing somewhat is always super funny.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was like the first time where around the same time, there was a game called like Dodgeball or Super Dodgeball, I think, where you had two teams and you could like run around. But then it was the first time I really noticed. I was like, oh, these guys really look like the same dudes. And they basically kind of reused like the character art or whatever, and across multiple games, right? And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. That's smart. You probably did that relatively quickly. I love the NES, and I love that there's all these retro NES things out now and emulators where you can just, you know, have hundreds of games in a little form factor and just fire up the old games. It's super cool.
Yeah, it's easy to travel back in time these days. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Get in touch with our old ways.
What about you guys? What was the first? I mean, Simon, you just mentioned you had the Game Boy as well, but how about you, Florian? I'm curious about, you know, your start with games.
Yeah, my first, I mean, we weren't allowed for quite some time until my early teens to have any. Nah, I was a bit younger, maybe 12, 10, somewhere around there. But we weren't allowed any games, so I also was playing at friends. I was more into books back then, but we had this Sega. It wasn't the Mega Drive. I think it was the Master System, where you had these cassettes. You put them in the top, and we used to play. Together with my brother, who's 2 years younger, Billy the Kid was one of the IPs that was, you had to beat your enemies by doing stone, scissor, paper. Mm-hmm. And so that was our first own one. Otherwise, we had a family that lived close by whose son was a few years older and he had a PC. So in that point, we sometimes were allowed to watch, not play ourselves, Monkey Island.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That was quite cool. But so my own story with games started quite a bit later. But yeah, I personally don't mind it that much. I feel like I got plenty of time afterwards to catch up. But I also had this uncle, actually, we were visiting relatives in the US when I was nine. Mm-hmm. And my uncle and aunt were traveling with the family and they had a Game Boy as well. So it was always cool to, like, on the trip, borrow it for a while and play some early Tetris and Mario stuff.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh, always such good feelings. I always love going back to this. So nice.
I know, me too.
Yeah, I was lucky. I had PCs in the house. So we, I had some really early PC time with my uncle, who's only 11 years older than I. So he was a bit like a big brother for me. And yeah, I had, you know, I was going to say I wasn't that desperate, but then I was like, well, I guess I was. I mean, I had some gaming time at home, and I also needed to go to many friends to game even more. I needed a lot of games in my life, that's for sure.
Yeah. I know the feeling.
I have a question. I would move it forward a bit. Flo, anything here or Steven you want to add?
No. Well, I think I one time, I'm not sure if I told it on this podcast, but what annoyed me about the Sega, which I always tell, is that there was the Echo the Dolphin game, if anybody remembers that.
Yeah.
And they were blasting it on TV like it was like coming out before, I guess, Christmas or something. And I said, oh my God, I need this. I was always seeing it, but it was always only available on the Mega Drive. So I was super frustrated that I couldn't get this game. And from that point, I really hated that Sega.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was like, why are they only putting it on the, I mean, at this point, obviously new generation of consoles, I completely understand. But at that point I was like, so how can you be Sega and then only put it on that console, but not on mine? That was, and then always my aunt was calling around and, in stores and saying, yeah, my nephew has this thing. Do you also have it for that? Because at that point there wasn't like, you could look it up on the internet and say, oh, of course, Sega only releasing it on this thing. You could see that within seconds now. Mm-hmm. But she was like, oh, maybe another store has it for that thing. And she was like going through people. And then in the end, well, it didn't work out, sadly. But so we realized that, oh, no, it will never come out on this thing.
Oh, so traumatizing.
really traumatizing.
I don't know how much you guys are into the console space, but there's still a lot of problems there. I mean, like trying to get a PS5, for example, or even I think last year, my friend and I, we got a game on, I think he has a PS5 and I had a PS4, and we were not able to play together. And we were like, what the hell are you guys doing? Right. It does.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of issues.
I was also going to say kind of as a callback to earlier, but you know, this Echo the Dolphin story reeks of bad publisher activity, you know?
Exactly.
If only there was something like Decker Games around, you know?
There
good,
you go.
Good yeah. consumer yes. publisher. Yeah.
I'm going to quickly look up who owns that IP and we'll try to resolve your childhood trauma, Florian.
Nice, thank you. At this point, I probably won't be able to find a console to then play it, or you have to port it to PC or something. I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, also for the completionists and the people who will say at one point that he's not really a gamer. There's always these people out there. Mm-hmm. The game I was referring to before was called Alex Kidd, not Billy Kidd. I don't know why I said it.
Okay.
So that was for anybody. I just Googled it because I was like, I don't think I said the right name. Yes. So there you go. Corrected on the record.
I am also looking at Echo the Dolphin right now, and it looks amazing. It's like,
yes.
I can totally feel your urge, the necessity to acquire this game. It looks fantastic.
I think somebody told me actually, because... Now we're getting into the story. We're completely drifting off. I'm sorry.
That's right.
But there's a guy called Reza Memari. Who also lives in Berlin. He has a studio called Telescope Animation, and they are also starting a game studio now. And he used to work in very old games, and I think they actually had something to do with that game. And I told him this story, and he was like, "Oh yeah, don't worry, you didn't play this game because it was actually super shit and it was hard as fuck."
Oh no!
So I was like, "Okay, my relationship is now a little bit mended," but. Yeah, because it could have been very frustrating. I think it also didn't really do that well. And like people got really frustrated with the game because it was so hard and everything. So maybe like that passed me by as well. And I'm better off for it. But yeah, just again, to complete the story.
Yeah,
you didn't. This isn't over yet, this saga. We will figure it out amongst all the people I gather now in the games industry. And then at one point I will hold it in my hands.
Let's do it.
Florian the human and Echo the dolphin. It is on. Moving it on. Let's see. I guess I was curious. We're fast forwarding. Feel free to tell any details you find important. But you know, looking at your continuing from the maybe slightly constrained thread, like you told us earlier as well, you did go into like traditional. A traditional mode of success, I would say, or a traditional concept of success, you know, consulting world, I think you said in the US as the beginning of your career, mm-hmm. and in Manhattan, and then like you said, over to Hong Kong to shake it up a bit, and then also from there into games. And I know that now you're also, like you said in the beginning, caring a lot about your general balance of life. So if I would paint that thread to me, it feels like you're kind of like, it feels like something like letting go, you know, like moving closer to your heart's desire, moving closer to something like a true and authentic and balanced life. And as far as I know, all that is very important to you. Am I getting this thread roughly right? B, mm-hmm. what would you like to share about that?
Yeah. That's a pretty good read, Simon. Thank you for saying that. And I would say you're fairly accurate. But I, you know, I don't want to say that I'm special in that regard. I think a lot of people, especially over the last 2.5 years, did kind of go through a lot of this soul searching and asking these existential questions, you know, what am I doing with my life? What do I want to be doing? And how do I want to spend my time? Am I really happy with what I'm doing? So I feel like for me that, you know, I'm really happy with my day job at Deka, but also trying to figure out how to do more meaningful work. And if that can be also related to the games industry, even better. So, you know, within the last year, I've gotten involved with several groups that are kind of moving in, I would say, similar direction or on similar wavelengths. So, you know, one of them is, you guys are already familiar with is the Games Forest Club. So almost a year old now, but essentially trying to encourage the games industry to be more sustainable. So, you know, the founders are really dear friends of mine and I'm helping them out as a ambassador of the company. And it's really gratifying to see how many people are on board with the cause and, you know, talking to them and they're both working harder than they've ever worked, but also getting up and loving their job and working with a purpose. And, so that's one of the areas that I'm really excited about. There's some other organizations that I'm talking to. And then within Embracer, we actually have a sustainability committee where we're trying to, look at these topics, like how can we be more green? How can we do more meaningful work? How can we have more diversity and inclusion in the workplace? That kind of thing. And we are meeting almost on a weekly basis and, basically giving nonprofits or companies that are doing really great work, a platform to share what they're doing with, the Embracer group as a whole. And I should mention that we're now over 120 studios, which is news to me. Before, I recently heard that. Before that, I was telling people we're 80 studios, but yeah, that's a lot of change that we can actually affect. So I'm really happy to be working with other interested parties there. And there's also some charities in the US that I'm actively talking to. So I think people are starting to realize that, hey, there's more to life than just being commercially driven and making money. And actually, if you can, you know, do some good as part of your, you know, your work as a game studio or a games publisher or whatever, even better, right? And I think a lot of times these can be win-win situations. And we've done this in the past, even I'm thinking back to when I was at Six Waves, you know, when you attach a charitable cause to a game, you actually get a lot more engagement than you expect. And specifically when one of the games that we were publishing, there was a tsunami in Japan, and we decided to very quickly run a campaign in the game. So we created a dedicated item within the game that, and all the proceeds from that item would go directly to the Red Cross towards tsunami relief, right? And the developer, Game Insight, at the time was completely on board. We like launched it in record time and raised a ton of money. And so, you know, that's just one example. But, you know, I think people are now seeing, you know, from talking to people in the industry, but also talking to players, they're so ready to do more and to try to make a difference if they can. And so, yeah, I'm really excited about where the direction that the whole industry as a whole is headed to. Hopefully we can get more people on board with all these cool initiatives.
Yeah. You're connecting this purpose-driven work with your work as well, like you're describing. Did you have I only know you as the very smooth, full of humility and gratitude, equanimous Stephen Lee.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Did you have a change in your life ever? Did you have like a wake up moment? Were you ever like angry or you know more tense and a mean consultant in New York City? some people just grow up like this as well and just kind of ease their way in. That's why I'm curious whether you had like a big change, a wake up, or whatever you would like to call it.
Yeah, there have been a few. I think you know, all young people have a lot of strong feelings and emotions, right? And I think I had, when I was younger, I definitely had a temper, and that came out a lot in competitive sports, for example, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Not necessarily.
But, you know, I remember when I was younger, road rage was definitely a thing. And now I don't know what's changed. I just don't really, it's not worth it for me to get angry at people. And I'm doing a really good job of trying to, you know, take that space to understand, okay, how can I be reacting to this situation? Is it helpful? Is this something I can control, right? Is this person, or, you know, doing this on purpose, probably, you know, to piss me off? Probably not. So a lot of times it's, you know, I choose to lead with kindness but I think, you're asking about like other shifts in my life. I have to confess, I did go through kind of like a midlife crisis. I wouldn't say it was a crisis, but it was more like, I want to explore and do lots of things. And related to that, you know, I had some people close to me pass away, and other close friends struggle with health. So that kind of jump-started my interest in health and fitness and I guess overall wellness. So that's been also something that's really important to me, that I'm also trying to bring into the games industry as well. And because I think physical, mental, emotional health is all interconnected, right? And if we're feeling strong and healthy and happy, and that makes us feel, you know, perform better at work too, right? And if we love the work that we're doing, that also inspires us to put more energy into it. And, you know, it's a kind of like a virtuous cycle, if you will. So,
yeah. And how do you practice that? Do you have some specific things that you practice?
Yeah. I'm learning all the time. I think, you know, when you meet other people that are also interested in health or personal development or learning and trying, you know, acquiring new skills or trying new things, it's very common to just compare notes, you know, like, what are you doing for your fitness and what are you doing? And so, for me, I think the biggest game changer recently has been the Wim Hof method. And I may have mentioned this to you a couple of years ago. So I started doing the Wim Hof method back in 2019 and went on a couple of expeditions with Wim Hof. And for listeners that don't know Wim Hof, just Google Wim Hof, W-I-M-H-O-F. His nickname is the Iceman, and he has all these world records for feats in extreme temperatures. And so I don't want to get into like sales mode, but basically the method is a combination of conscious breath work, cold exposure, and also mindset. And those three things are interrelated. So I've been doing that for every day for the last, I would say, 3 years. And it's made a huge difference in my my energy, my stress levels, you know, being more open to connect with others. And I believe in it so much that, you know, I think a lot of my friends are always kind of like asking me about it. So, you know, can you teach us, you know, can you show us? I'd love for you to lead me through the breathing or do a nice bath together. And so I've always wanted to do that and to help people. And so, but I didn't want to do that without the proper instruction. So actually earlier this year, I became a certified Wim Hof instructor, and I'm now doing that for friends and family, let's say, but also I'm going to be doing more workshops around Berlin and other parts of the world. One of the things I like to do before a conference like GDC or Gamescom is get together with friends, and we do stuff like that. I lead them through breathing, or we go out in nature and we jump in the ocean, and it always leaves us feeling very centered and energized and kind of ready to tackle, you know, really, really hectic weeks. So, yeah, trying to integrate all that into the games industry as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's so good. I've had this thought so much. I never really pulled the trigger on it, but they're in games. I don't know if it's in games, in the games industry that I know, the Twitch area of things, you know, where there's a bit of fame and stars and glory. And I know that's also amongst the producers and distributors of games. Like the whole games industry has a bit of a fast rock star character to it, which is cool because I think, you know, not all, but many gamers come from the fringes a little bit, and mm-hmm. and the whole industry became really cool. And so you're now successful and have resources, maybe money, maybe recognition, and you can go really fast and so on. And it can have unhealthy tendencies. If you're not, you know, if you're actually growing up as a nerd, you know, not a walker in between the worlds, then maybe you're not so many gamers that I know are not so connected with their bodies and all that. So, and, you know, something a bit higher and wider than them, you know, whether that's your breath or however you get into a bit of an elevated state. So this is, I really like that you do this now, especially, or even if you just do it for your immediate groups, because yeah, I always had the same thought. It would be nice to teach some meditation and some introspection and some like kind of balancing methods to gamers, to streamers, people who are like on the air all the time. They need some grounding, you know? And so there are all these. There's a lot of counterbalance, I think, that the industry needs, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think a lot of times online, you know, like the Twitch streamers and, you know, any online platform, there's so much, you know, toxicity, right? And people need to chill out a little bit. So I think, you know, meditation, as you mentioned, is a great way to do that. And you know, just being more mindful and yeah, just trying to you know, take care of yourself, right? And with what you're consuming. And yeah, one of the reasons why I don't spend a lot of time on some of these platforms. But, you know, there are people that are spreading good messages too, which is, I think, is great. And that's one of the nice things about Twitch sometimes.
Yeah. So if you would, If you would be up for this, what is if somebody says, okay, Stephen, senpai, please teach me, what is a simple way you can breathe, for example, a simple breathing exercise that somebody might want to do or that you impart on this audio format for us right
now? Yeah, absolutely. So the Wim Hof method is pretty simple. I would say like it's basically three rounds of basically intentional breathing. So you're, you know, taking really big inhales and just letting go on the exhale. And you do this for 30, 40 times. And then that's one round. And at the end of the round, you sort of sit there and the body's surprisingly can exist after that round without needing to breathe for some people for several minutes. And that's super cool to see. And then once you do that, you hold your breath as long as you can, and then you take a big breath, hold it in for 10 to 15 seconds. And that's one round, and then you repeat and you do that three times, or, you know, at a minimum, but you could you can go for much longer if you want to. And you know, some people, I've done breathing sessions that have been over an hour, and you go really deep and you get super high. And it's really fun, but I think, some really simple ways and some principles, just in general, nasal breathing is a big one. Not enough people breathe through their nose, but it's just by all accounts, much better for us. The other thing is if you're feeling really stressed out, there's this, your whole respiratory system is a combination of inhaling and exhaling, right? And when you're breathing in more than when your inhale is greater than your exhale, you're getting more excited because you're getting more oxygen into your cells. If you're looking to calm down, it's actually better to focus on a longer exhale. So make sure the exhalation is longer than the inhalation. So that's activating, you know, I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but the parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest system, and it calms you down. So in a pinch, if you want to just calm down, what helps a lot is just to make sure that your exhales are longer than your inhales. Some other techniques that work really well. I don't know if you guys have heard of 4-7-8. There's a 4-7-8 breathing technique. So basically you're breathing in for 4 seconds. You hold your breath for 7 seconds, and then you're exhaling for 8 seconds. So 4-7-8. And it's a really simple, easy way to kind of reset your system and just calm down. I would highly recommend that one. A lot of other people do what's called box breathing. And that's essentially like breathing in for 4, holding for 4, exhaling for a count of 4, and then holding for 4 again. And you just repeat that as well. So those are two pretty simple and really easy ways to reset your system if you're feeling really stressed.
Yeah, that's good. I think 4-7-8 and box breathing are the easiest ones to do. Absolutely. You can just kind of sit there and be like 4 seconds in, and then you hold it, and then 4 seconds out, you hold it. And I've heard of people who do this in the morning when they wake up to like kind of get into their bodies instead of immediately being in their heads and being distracted. And it seems to help people a lot.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it. You can do it anytime, you know, if you're on the U-Bahn even, you know, noisy environment, you can just do it and no one knows what you're doing. But I guarantee you, if you're just even being more aware of your breath, I mean, which is essentially what you're doing when you meditate, and you will feel better. And that's, you know, that's not just me saying it. It's scientifically proven, right? So, not to go too deep in the weeds, but if anyone ever has any questions, I'm happy to help.
Yeah. And I guess from my end, and Flo, I hope you enjoyed the Simon's psychological, I don't know what the format is called.
Psychoanalysis by Simon.
Yep. Yeah, the segment usually gets different names depending on a little bit the topic. Today I don't have a specific name, but I really enjoyed it. I googled some of the stuff while you were talking. I looked at a video of people doing that stuff, and then to be also fair, I actually also on the side got a little bit off track because I found out actually that, that Echo the Dolphin actually exists on Steam. So, so I bought it for 99 cents. Just now, everybody out there, 99 cents. It's also part of the Sega Mega Drive, whatever bundle. Nice. So you can get tons of them. So
resolving the whole arc in one episode. Who would have thought?
Satisfying conclusion.
So I know, what the weekend holds.
Amazing. That's so funny. I would call this segment today Breathe with Stephen Lee. I think it has a good phonetic
energy. Yeah, that kind of rhymes.
Yeah. Breathe with Stephen Lee. And, you know, I want to bring it back to one topic that we might want to ride it out on before we go into essential questions. But you mentioned community. And just to go off a story that I have right now and to go off your breathing, I have joined an artist residency, or I was accepted into an artist residency. I'm there now working on my writing, and I'm there with a group of people, and they're all, you know, pretty well-versed in all sorts of matters of the internal, of the introspection, of the psychological, of the spiritual, and that's very cool. And everybody there kind of knows how to move and how to breathe and so on. And so when you're in a group of people like that, or what I've experienced now is that you can actually very easily ask everybody for a deep breath. And it's very funny. The whole room just goes like, you know, and then you can feel the energy shift. And so it's crazy. When you're alone in the world, or I know many people feel like that, and you're not connecting to or with people so much, and it feels a bit silly, right, to do your box breathing, you know, huffing and puffing on the U-Bahn. But in a way, like, if you imagine yourself amongst people who do the same, like, that you can kind of co-regulate with or something like that, it's actually a whole different ballgame. And somebody kind of calling for a big breath can be a big gift, and everybody can, you know, calm down together. And imagine a whole U-Bahn card taking a big breath together. Like, even just that act can be so connecting, which is kind of nuts. And so bringing it to community, you said it's so important for you. I would like to hear from you about what community means for you, because I'm also now moving from what I feel is a very individualistic arc to a much more communal arc, which is very funny and new to me and exciting. And would love to hear from you as a seasoned community team player. Yeah, why that's important in your life, community.
Yeah, first of all, amazing. Congrats on you finding your new tribe. I think that's wonderful. And you know, when you're, it's very natural, right? When you're with a group of people, you're helping each other and, you know, you play at that level, right? So when you're able to be with other, people that are living intentionally and interested in these kinds of things, you're growing together. So I think that's super, amazing that you're doing that. I'm excited for you and see where this leads for you. For me, I think I'm doing quite a bit. I think part of it was also out of necessity. You know, when you move to Berlin, it can be kind of a transient, tough city to make friends in. And so, you know, especially as a middle-aged non-German speaker, it's kind of like, hey, you know, will you be my friend? You know, it's like kind of like a lot of people have their established friend groups, right? That the people they've known from this or that, or that they've already known for a long time. And so a lot of times it feels tough to break into that and be accepted. And I'm sure a lot of people listening know what I'm talking about. So I've kind of shifted focus a little bit. So instead of just really being single-mindedly looking to attach myself to people, it's more like changing the mindset to say, okay, let's focus on myself and let's do the things that I really enjoy, that make me happy, right? And so, one of the things I've done the last 2 years has been comedy. So I've been learning and practicing improv comedy in Berlin, and there's a really great community there. So I've expanded my community in that way. And then, the Wim Hof Method, as I mentioned, I mean, one of my favorite things about that community is how amazing people are. Everyone is so nice and so open, and Wim himself is just loves everyone, and he's just he can just unlock everyone's heart, and even the most jaded person or the most macho guy, they're when you're all together, there's this this community spirit. And I've been in breathing sessions with over 100 people, and people are bawling their eyes out at the end of it, right? Because that energy, that group energy that you share is really powerful. So I'm very grateful to be a part of that community as well. And taking it up a little bit to a higher level, I mean, tying it in with this podcast, I think the games industry is an amazing community. For such a massive industry, the amount of business that is done, it's actually a pretty small and very well-connected community. And what I love about working in the games industry is that almost everyone is just an awesome person, really nice guy, creative, open. Obviously everyone can do better, but I also think that the industry is really good at self-regulating sometimes. If someone is an asshole, it's pretty obvious, and people kind of know. And if people are nice, people also know that. So, I think we're blessed to be working with some of the most amazing people, and it's a wonderful games industry community that we have. So I guess that sort of concludes my thoughts on community.
Really nice. Yeah. Simon, I think at this point we should come to our final part of the show, and Stephen told us that he actually was happy to be asked to join because he's also a listener, so he knows what's coming up next.
But I haven't had actually a lot of time to brainstorm this, but yeah, I'm excited. Fire away, guys.
So yeah, Simon, let's move to the essential questions.
Let's move to the essential question. Yeah, and thank you for sharing that. Hear it again and again, the community aspect of the games industry. I've kind of stepped out a little bit, but it always warms my heart to see how much it means for everybody, and to also take that seriously. And yeah, like you said earlier, we can count ourselves lucky to be if we're part of this. So yes. Yeah, thank you for underlining that, sharing that.
Preach.
Okay, then. Essential questions, a couple of questions. It's good, I think, that you're not prepared. We'd like to keep it on the spot here. This is straight to the point, honest, unfiltered, only on GamesNet Berlin Europe, really, where you get this type of conversation. Pew, 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 pew. Okay. Everybody did their dabs, their air horns. Okay, we're ready. Question number one, as always, what inspires you, Steven?
Yeah, so much actually. I feel inspiration a lot, and I think I was trying to find a common thread, and not to get woo woo, but I think the common thread in things that inspire me would be love. So, and that boils down to like people that really care and that act from the heart. And so like when I see people selflessly helping others, that's really inspiring. We're seeing that a lot more now, which is wonderful. And I think, for a long time, a lot of people just have their, especially in big cities, people have their heads down, running around, worrying about their lives and not really thinking about others. And so that part of it is really inspiring. Yesterday when I was just arrived in here in Tel Aviv, like the waitress at this cafe I sat down in, and it just gave me a huge smile and was like, welcome. And I was like, wow, that is super, super like, inspiring in a way, because she doesn't know me from Adam, right? And she decided to, extend, like a really warm welcome. And I love that. And tying it into, you know, games, you know, people that love what they do, right? Devotion to your craft, people that love what they do and put everything into it, right? That could be absolutely game developers, right? But also musicians, athletes who put in the work and, you know, give it their all, right? That's super inspiring. One of the reasons why I go to a lot of gigs and that kind of thing. And then, I don't know, have you guys ever spent a lot of, I travel a lot, so I spend a lot of time in airports, but I don't know if you guys ever did this, but as a happy accident, I was with some friends and we were waiting in the arrivals hall of the airport and seeing people reunite and just like, you know, the love that they give each other. That's also super inspiring, right? The love that a partner has for their partner or for a child has for their parent. That really makes my heart go crazy. And I find a lot of inspiration from that.
Nice. Nice. Oh, you know, just me and my homies hang out in the arrivals hall, soaking up the love
exactly. from the people. Exactly. We were actually waiting for someone, right? But we were like, oh man, we're going to have to wait a while because the flight's delayed. But it ended up being such a hidden blessing because we got to see so much of that. And it's awesome. I can highly recommend it. Berlin Airport is not my favorite, but if you hang out at the arrivals hall, I guarantee you, you'll find some love there.
Yeah.
Find me someone whose favorite airport Berlin Airport is. just as a general, that's also a thing I learned in Berlin. You have to find everything shit. So our airport sucks.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is a totally separate podcast that I could talk
about. Except for the arrivals hall.
Yes.
It's yeah. great. What are you exactly. doing this weekend? Want to soak up some love in the arrivals hall? Yeah. I love this. This is a whole new. If you ever want to, you know, you need some, maybe this is a bit, Stephen, maybe you can make a comedy bit out of this. I can kind of see it. Okay. Okay. Moving on. Question number two. What would you say is the purpose of your being?
Yeah, my purpose. I thought about this before the podcast because I've been doing a lot of work over the years. My purpose in life is to spread joy, love, and kindness, to support others and hopefully have a positive impact on anyone I interact with.
Beautiful. And number three, what's a beautiful day for you?
Yeah, beautiful day is most importantly quality time with people I care about, being active, getting sunshine, water, good food, lots of laughs, great music. Those are the key elements.
Couldn't agree more. What is the change you want to see in the world?
I'd love to see more people acting or thinking more selflessly, and more thinking about how they can help others. I think that's, the world would be a much better place if we could, have that kind of change.
Mm. And how would you say you contribute to that wish?
By trying to do that when I can, I think we're all guilty of sometimes not. Or being in our own heads and maybe not being so aware of what's happening with other people. But I try to do this when I can and hopefully, I don't know, being the best version of myself. And maybe if people see what I'm doing, then people can follow suit and, you know, kind of pay it forward.
Awesome. I almost forgot. Well, if you would start a new save game in your life right now, what occupation would your new character have?
Oh, man, I really love this question. I think my instinct would be to stay in the games industry, but I think I would love to be on the development side for once. I think it's might be everyone's dream to see their, you know, their name in the credits of a hit game. That sounds really fun. But if I wasn't in the games industry, it would be some combination of health and fitness, coaching, maybe music as a backup plan.
Music as a backup plan. It's like
very practical, yeah.
the classic. If it doesn't work out, I'll just be an artist, right? That's what we all do. Yeah, exactly. That's pretty funny. And for the educational purposes, do you have books or a book that you often, that you like to recommend to people, or that you maybe even like to give it as a gift?
Yeah, for sure.
Three maybe?
Yeah, definitely. The one I've recommended the most in the last couple of years would be a book called Breath. We talked about breathwork earlier, but Breath by James Nestor is a really good one. He did a lot of self-experimentation and research on the different types of breath work and what people are doing wrong. And that was, I found that super interesting and easy to read. So that's one. I think another one I would say is a book called Humankind. I don't remember the author's name. It was Rutger something. I'm just quickly going to look it up.
I'll tell you. Rutger Bregman.
Bregman, that's it. Yeah. So, he does a really great job of explaining how, so, you know, there's this perception that people are assholes or, you know, only serve in their self-interest, let's say. And he does a really good job of refuting that and showing examples throughout history and culture where, people are inherently good. So I found it to be really hopeful and really educational, really interesting. So that would be my other choice.
Sweet. Thank you for sharing that. Over to you, Mr. Florian.
Yes. So same question, but different medium. What are your favorite games? 1 to 3.
Yeah, we talked about the early ones already, like Tetris, right? I got really into musical games. You know, I think we all, we talked about music before. So, you know, Guitar Hero, Rock Band were really games I played all the time.
Nice.
And then currently there's the game BeatStar by Space Ape is doing really well. I'm still playing that on mobile. Aside from that, my strong preference, I'm actually, you know, even though for work I'm mostly focused on mobile games, on a personal level, I'm only playing console games. So I have a strong preference for co-op games and only co-op games because that's how I keep in touch with my friends in other parts of the world. So but we don't really play multiplayer PvP because it's not fun and you know, it's really dependent on ping and it's also really toxic. So we play a lot of co-op PvE games where we're, you know, like trying to solve something or complete a challenge. So Portal was, you know, a really big one, like a lot of the Bungie games like Halo, Destiny, Rainbow Six, a lot of the games from the Rebellion, like over COVID, I was playing Zombie Army 5, I think it's called. But basically, you're not only killing zombies, but you're killing Nazi zombies. So that was really fun.
Very important, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Super critical. And who doesn't want to kill Zombie Hitler? So, yeah, and then, you know, the exception of non-co-op games would be games that have won, like, Game of the Year, right? So, like, Uncharted or, like, during COVID, I played Ghost of Tsushima, which was just unbelievable. And they ended up randomly launching a co-op mode as well, which was great. So I ended up being able to play that with my friends anyway. So, yeah, that one also comes to mind as well.
All right. Who is somebody from the games industry who you would like to get to know?
I don't have a great answer for this one. I don't know. I guess maybe Tim Sweeney. I think he's, you know, definitely, you know, forward thinking and trying to do good in the industry. So, and obviously in a great position to make some changes. So maybe him and as a 1A and a 1B, maybe Hideo Kojima, because, you know, he brought a lot of joy to a lot of people and seems to be super creative. So I'd love to hear his stories and you know, sit down and break bread with him.
Sweet. Yes. You may or may not know this, but we always have this small task, which is kind of easy. We do it all the time for people. We set this trap for us in a way. It's a trap to for you basically, but in the end, it's basically us who have to do it. Is that we will try to connect you with those people that you mentioned, because that's also part of the purpose of this project, is connecting people. So some people make it easy in their wishes, some people make it hard, but Hideo Kojima, I think I will find in my notebook somewhere the number.
Nice. I love it. I applaud the effort. Yeah, it's awesome. I thought of another reason why it would be great to talk to Tim Sweeney, because I think you could just, you know, ask him for money. And
yeah, all right. Yeah, like,
you know, exactly.
While I'm at it, hey, Steven wants to meet you. Also, I need some money.
Yeah, also a couple bills here and there for our new studio or our new podcast. Why not?
Perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, should be no problem, really.
Yeah, I think this one will be easy. Who is someone you know who you think we should have on the podcast?
I mean, we do have a ton of great people in the industry. I think the first person that pops into my head would be Dirk de Huys, who's the CEO of Paladin Studios in the Netherlands. I consider him a really good friend, but most importantly, I think he's you know, deep thinker. He's been in the industry for a long time and super creative, and also into spiritual growth. And every time we hang out, we're inspiring each other. And I think he has a lot of wisdom and insight that he could share with you and your audience.
Super cool. I actually met him once or twice. I'm not super connected with him, but that would be a really cool guest.
Yeah, happy to make that introduction for you guys.
Thank you. I think so too, by the way. I met Dirk once, and actually outside the games industry in the more spiritual realm.
Nice.
That was very funny. That was very fun. Oh, you're in the games industry. Oh, me too, you know. And so, plus one for Dirk. Maybe we'll find him.
Awesome.
Cool. Last question, where can people find you, meaning online, your channels, your like social links? Where?
Yeah, I guess LinkedIn would be the most normal. That's not the right word. That'd probably be the best way for industry people to reach out. So my handle or profile is the name Steve, but instead of an S, it's the number 8. And that handle is good for LinkedIn, Facebook, Insta, whatever you're feeling. I guess LinkedIn would be probably the best, unless you already know me.
So it's 8TEVE.
That is correct.
Ah, yeah. Steve. Yeah, that's nice. Okay. 8TEVE. Find Stephen Lee.
Yeah.
Maybe for some breathing.
Yeah, sure.
You could have your own jingle with that.
Yeah.
Let's workshop that.
Cool. Funny enough, my cats are telling me that the episode is over. They need some food.
Nice.
Awesome. Yeah. Before we wrap, I just want to say thank you guys so much for reaching out and for the opportunity. And I have to say, I already said this earlier, but I really admire what you guys are doing. And it's wonderful that you're giving wonderful people in the industry, I'm not including myself, but you know, people in the industry like a forum to share things and not only focusing on the business aspect, but also on us as human beings. So, you know, kudos to you guys and more power to you. And yeah, I really hope that, you know, this goes on, because I think you're providing a great forum for lots of people.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being our guest.
My pleasure. Yeah,
means a lot. Thank you very much. Very good to talk to you. And thank you for sharing everything that you shared with us.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks so much. And see you back in Berlin very soon.
All right. Goodbye. Bye-bye. See you.
Take care.
Hi there. Simon here. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you like what you hear here and you would like to hear more here, feel free to follow or to subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you get your audio fix. We appreciate you, and we promise you to bring you many more insightful conversations with fantastic games industry guests from Berlin and from all over Europe. Thank you very much, and see you very soon. Bye-bye.
Hi there. Before you go, this is Florian, project manager for GamesNet Berlin Europe. If you want to stay connected to the network, find out more about upcoming events and links to other MediaNet initiatives, you can visit us at gamesnetberlin.eu and subscribe to our newsletter. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, and until next time.